qualche cosa sta
Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news, behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring, and I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being until we ask for calls, because, sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. Right now we have us on the line from up in Oregon, Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute, and Jerry does help us bring you the programs. And Jerry, how are you doing up there? How's the rain doing?
It is raining again, but it is windy, windy. On the East Coast, they would call this a hurricane, but here they just call it wind. We're blowing around. I think we have gusts up to 80 miles an hour here.
Well, I think that, Kirsten, we have to go through the winter before we get to the spring, and it's time to start putting those gardens in. And, of course, that's what ARC Institute is all about, is providing the seeds people need for, you know, for growing their own vegetable gardens. And people say, oh, well, gee, why should we do that? And yet, I will tell you, you know, the more I read about what they're doing with genetic foods, and the more I read the reports about the disastrous animal studies that we're seeing with certain of the genetically modified corn and certainly cotton. People say, well, why should I be worried about if they genetically modified cotton? Well, I'll tell you why. Because they make cottonseed oil that you use in a lot of things in cooking, and of course it's genetically modified. And we know what the animal studies show, certainly with many of these products. I mean, there's serious health problems with the animals. What about human beings? Well, they don't seem to be so worried about that. So anyway, let's get your take on what's going on, Jerry.
Sure. Well, I remember a while back, Dr. Stan, you and I were having a conversation about your garden, and I said to you, you know, I'm going to send you some seed right away, because to tell you the truth, Stan, I don't know from one day to the next whether or not the ARC Institute will be able to ensure, or anyone will be able to ensure, that their crops have not been crossed with genetically modified crops growing in their areas. And I told you at that time that one of the most serious challenges we faced was the fact that these genetically modified crops were being spread despite people's protests around the world. And if we look at the year 2005, you can see the underlying reason that this is becoming the case, because the year between 2004 and 2005 already, we had seen an upsurge in industry takeovers, mergers and acquisitions between among companies that manufacture seed and manufacture pesticides. And increasingly, they have so concentrated the seed and chemical industries that right now we're looking at the top 10 companies in the world that now control 51% of all the food eaten in the world. 10 companies. And we have top 10 companies that control all the pesticides in the world. And for those of you in the audience who are listening tonight and you want to grab a pencil, to take some of this data down, the studies have just come out for this past year and the 2004 to 2005 year, and they're absolutely stunning. For example, we have number one at the top of our seed company list is our friend Monsanto.
All right, you hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti. Ladies and gentlemen, there are people who are taking over control of the food production in the country, in the world, but they're doing some very dangerous things to our crops. Well, Jerry, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story there?
Sure. If I just rattle off the list, and this is kind of to show you where we're actually going. The top 10 seed companies in the world in order of the amount of seed sales they have in a year are Monsanto, which just took over Seminese Seed. And now Monsanto Seminese is the largest in the world, followed by DuPont, Syngenta, Group Lima Grain from France, KWS Germany, Land of Lakes, United States, Cicada in Japan, Bayer Crop Science, that's out of Germany now, Taiki, Japan, Trifolium in Denmark, and Delta and Pine Land Company, which you have heard me talk about many times, that's the originator of the Terminator gene, here in the United States with the USDA. That's the top 10. Now again, Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, Group Lima Grain, and so on. Now listen to the top 10 pesticide producers. Bayer, Syngenta, BASF, Dow, Monsanto, DuPont, a Japanese firm, Sumitomo, Nufarm, and Arista in Japan. Now, what we find out is that all of the seed companies are GM seed companies, genetically modifying them, all the seeds. And we have them now taking over 51% of the food supply in the entire world. Why is this so important? Well, if the food supply is controlled by this handful of 10 companies, you're not getting research in, for example, GM-free seeds, right? Because these companies are genetically engineering companies. They are the ones who are doing these chemical and molecular biology genetic engineering techniques. The food supply, therefore, is going to be vulnerable to the whims of their business. It's going to be vulnerable to market maneuvers. Why is that important? Because important to these companies, number one, is increasing the profitability for their investors and for their own profit margins. It is not about providing you with the food that you want to eat or to provide you with the best food for you to eat. It is about business. That's what it is. It's the bottom line. It's also making it, because there's, again, 10 companies, it's also making it very difficult for farmers to choose to grow the seeds that they want, because they're simply not going to be available if these 10 companies are the ones providing most of the seed to farmers. And don't you know, that's exactly what's happened in 2004 and 2005. The amount of acreage around the world that is being grown to genetically modified seeds.
Well, that's all right there. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Terry was simply saying that there are about 10 companies that control over 51% of the seed production, in the entire world. And then, of course, many of these same companies are in the pesticide business, and you'll find a go down the list of the people who are making the seeds, and, of course, these are genetically modified seeds, because, after all, when you can genetically modify it, then you can patent it, and you can make a great deal of money. And then, of course, what they're actually doing with some of the crops, for instance, the corn. Have you ever noticed how great those ears of corn are today? Why, there are no caterpillars there. I can remember, when we used to buy corn, and you'd always shuck it down to the very base, and you'd see where the caterpillars had been in there. Well, you don't see caterpillars in our corn now, and one reason you don't is because they put something in the corn that'll kill the caterpillar. It's an insecticide or pesticide that they actually put the gene in there, and the caterpillar comes along. He's really so happy. He's got this ear corn, and he eats a little of this. And of course, it's in the husk. It's in the whole thing. He eats a little of that, and he just drops over dead. Isn't that wonderful? Now we've got corn without caterpillars, but the question is, what does it do to human beings? And what are the long-term studies, effect of this? And, of course, in the animal studies, they're really rather frightening. And, of course, but 10 years from now, why, we'll find out. Maybe we'll find out what we found out after giving pregnant women or threatening to miscarriage estrogens. We did that for many years. And then we found out that their daughters, they grew up, had cancer of the vagina. And there was a very definite relationship to this mass experiment that was carried out on the women of the United States. And not only did the daughters have the cancer of the vagina, but their daughters had cancer of the vagina as well. So now, of course, two generations later, we're seeing still the disastrous effects of this mass experiment on the women of the world. And now, of course, they're experimenting us with these GMO foods. And certainly Jerry is pointing out that certainly that we do not know the long-term effects. But what we do know that some of these genetically modified foods are really very dangerous, and any scientist who speaks out against that, against the animal studies that show that animals die eating these GMO foods, and many of the animals are too smart to eat them, they have to be force-fed them, the scientists who come out with these studies lose their jobs, can never get a job again. Could this really be going on in the world?
You betcha.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Bacillus thuringiensis gene manipulation, the studies that were done by Monsanto had actually shown in the experimental group only defects in kidney, and I don't have the numbers in front of me tonight because I'm looking at these other studies, but there were defects in the kidneys and defects in the blood composition and so on, and they literally dismissed them and said it was inconsequential. It had no bearing on the diet that they were fed, which was just laughable, absolutely laughable, and other scientists around the world began to say, we want to see the whole study. But, of course, this is a private firm, and these are all private firms, not governmental. By private, I mean not governmental. I'm not talking about investing or non-investing. At any rate, they are private firms doing this research, supporting, of course, the sale of their own products, which has increased also because of this concentration of money. Not in the public sector anymore, where governments were doing research for their people and for the betterment of farmers' livelihoods and so on. No more. Now it's done by the chemical companies and the seed companies who are producing the product themselves. And, of course, they're doing studies themselves and then assuring the governments that everything is safe and rosy. We know that that's not the truth. And we have seen now some of the studies to prove it's not the truth. And what happens? We protest. They protest all over Europe. Here in the United States, where most of the GM foods are grown, most of our people here aren't protesting, but they are protesting like heck in the rest of the world. And it's not getting them anywhere because of this concentration of power and product and market in the handful of a few companies whose names I rattled off, and they are planting seed, having seed planted out all around the world. And unfortunately, Stan, this is contaminating all of the non-GMO seed. And you and I have talked about Terminator and Verminator and all of those other genetically modified seeds that are absolutely dangerous to the environment in terms of canceling out life on the planet, plant life on the planet, if this stuff gets out and is spread widely throughout plants. And we talk about that again, too. But the reality is, this pollen is not in check. It is pure human arrogance to think that we can put these things in a field and they're not going to spread. In fact, they are spreading as we speak. Genetically modified canola is becoming a pest on the prairies of Canada, where it is, and unfortunately, it's taking more and more and more herbicide to try to kill off weeds now because they are becoming resistant to glyphosate or Roundup.
Now, basically, what they've done is they've taken the canola and certain of the other product, corn products and soy, and they put in this Roundup Ready gene so that
right.
The Roundup will not kill the plants, and so they can spray easily. And then they just spray away the weeds. They don't have to worry about them. The trouble is, then you begin to get Roundup-resistant weeds.
That's right.
And, of course, what does the effect of the this gene that they now put into the corn and the canola and the soy and these other products have? And there's some very frightening studies. And those of you who haven't read Jeffrey Smith's book entitled Seeds of Deception, that's Seeds of Deception, or we carry a book called Beware GMOs by Beware GMOs, Genetically Modified Food, tells about, you know, some of this genetically modified corn they were feeding to the pigs, you know, on the farms, and the pigs, the male pigs, were all becoming sterile, and actually at least one of the farmers went bankrupt because, of course, the male pigs couldn't sire the female pigs, and that was the end of his business. And this was spreading throughout the entire pig industry until they realized it was genetically modified corn that was doing that. Has anybody studied what's going on in America today? I mean, what about the increasing incidence of erectile dysfunction among men today? Does anybody wonder why so many men are taking all these various types of drugs that are being advertised, and why we see all these pictures of the smiling men? Because now they're taking these drugs, but why do they need to take them today? And I would like to suggest that there are many reasons, but certainly one of them, I believe, may be many of these genetically modified foods. But that great book, Seeds of Deception, Beware GMOs, the second book, and, of course, material we have a 4-tape set on this, is must for anybody who really cares about their health and the health of their family. And as Jerry says, in Europe, the people are frantically trying to stop it.
Right.
But because of the degree of control over the media here in America, Most people, simply say, well, after all, the government would never allow something that was dangerous to be released on the American people, would it?
Well, here, you know, this is what the problem is, too. We have in these major bio and pharmaceutical firms people in research and in management positions who are rotating into the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Food and Drug Administration, and so on in our administration. It's a revolving door. Then they come out of government, they go back into these firms, and so on. They have the best lobbyists in the world, these bio firms and these pharmaceutical firms and seed companies, the best lobbyists in the world. When the Senate Science Committee is given a teach-in, an instructional session so that they can make legislation, what they do is get lectured to by top scientists in these firms who are very PR-oriented. They are essentially scientific lobbyists lobbying for a particular position. Now, if you think that's not the truth, check your own state and see what your state's position is on GM foods being imported or sold into the state and GM seeds. Turns out several states, yours included, Stan, I think, in several areas, they said that there was going to be no GM food and seed allowed in those communities or counties or so on. Well, you know what happened? The seed industry and the chemical industry got together with legislators, and they helped them to write legislation that preempted those kinds of rulings by the people for their own communities. And the legislatures have passed them. I think there are 14 states now that have passed legislation that says that the people may not exclude genetically modified seeds and food from their markets in certain communities.
And you know, what's really interesting, Jerry, is that in Europe, they insisted that everything be marked if it was genetically modified food. The people wanted to know it, and if they knew it, they would not buy it. Here in the United States, they do not allow that sort of labeling. In other words, if we wanted to put out a product that said this is not genetically modified, they wouldn't let you do that.
No, you're not allowed to. You're not even allowed to put on milk that it does not contain hormone-treated cattle's milk, cow's milk. You're not allowed to put it on because our FDA's position on that is if we put that on, then it gives consumers the false notion that hormones added to the milk, to the cow, to overproduce milk is in some way defective or dangerous or different than, and they claim it is essentially the same. Well, you're talking about things like erectile dysfunction and other sexual problems and so on, and early puberty in girls and late sexual maturity in boys. Well, when you get estrogenic-type compounds and hormones that stimulate estrogen production in bodies, that might explain part of the problem. And that is hormones being placed in milk and meat and elsewhere to increase weight on animals and milk production.
Well, there are a lot of things going on out there.
Yes.
And the average person really doesn't seem to be too concerned. And the reason they're not concerned is because they will not allow this sort of material to get into the general media. And if it does, it'll be mentioned one day and never again. Because, you see, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed. Our ideas are suggested largely by men we have never heard of. We'll pick up the story there, Jerry.
Sure. If we could go just take a look at what has happened in 2004, and now we're studying the results from 2005, and we'll have that report pretty soon, too. But in 2004, let's just take the number one largest seed company, Monsanto. It has accounted now for 88% of the total GM crop area worldwide. This one company has 88% of genetically modified crops worldwide. This is huge, huge. Soybeans, 91% of worldwide GM soybeans in 2004, Monsanto. Corn, or maize as it's called, 97%. And that is, BT corn, for example, that's Monsanto again. Cotton, 63.5%, and canola 59%, worldwide GM canola in 2004. Now, 2005 numbers are probably going to be bigger. Now, let's talk about market share. Around the world, one company, Monsanto, now controls in 2004 41% of the global market share. And then, of course, you take that number, 41% of the global market, and then it has, that was for corn and maize, and 97% of that is genetically engineered. Now, do you wonder why I say the Ark Institute has been growing seed for our customers, actually for folks around the world? We've been growing it genetically modified, free, non-GMO seed, non-hybrid, the way God intended for us to grow things. We've been doing this for years. It is becoming increasingly difficult for our growers to isolate themselves from the wind, because this stuff is spreading so fast around the world.
It's spreading by pollen, in other
it's
words.
Spread by pollen, by the wind, and by insects. And we have been asking people since 1996 to please grow these clean crops all over this country, all over the world. Protect them if you're in an area that has a large proportion of commercial crops growing. Protect them with wind barriers, and you can make these things up very easily out of agricultural fabric, brick like Remay, and put them around one plant that you're going to take the seed from, or a few plants that you're going to take the seed from, to keep them clean from GMO pollen. And then harvest your seeds and give them away. Keep some for yourself and give them away, and have other people do the same. Because in fact, Stan, if we have an event in this world, such as nuclear war or a bioterrorist attack that kills off vast numbers of people, or an agro-terrorism attack that kills off massive crops, which is a very likely scenario, your folks, the folks that are listening now, will actually have the ability to come back up from the ashes. Will have the ability to feed others again, because number one, the seed is non-GMO. Number two, it's non-hybrid, so you can raise it year after year after year and save the seed. And number three, you're going to have in your hands the ability to provide seed and food for other people, literally forever, from one single purchase. Because these are forever kinds of things. This is the way nature intended for you.
Hold that stuff right there, Jerry. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jerry was just saying that all across the country, like seeds are being contaminated, crops are being contaminated, because you can't stop insects from carrying the genes from these genetically modified crops into other fields and contaminating the various crops there, and certainly the pollen is being spread. And so increasingly we're finding the contamination of so many of the various products that we grow and which we depend upon for our food supply. And certainly the power is in the hands predominantly of Monsanto, and they're controlling the vast majority of the genetically modified food throughout the world, and they are increasingly using ever larger amounts of, in other words, they're controlling the majority of the corn crops and the soybean crops and the canola crops in both here in Canada, throughout the world. And very soon you're not going to find non-genetically modified foods available. Why would anybody do that? You know, when these are potentially very dangerous. And if you read Jeffrey Smith's wonderful book, Seeds of Deception, and if you'd like to know more about the book, why, it is available through Radio Liberty, and you certainly can call us, and we'd be glad to tell you about that. But the information is out there. You need to have it. So pick up the story there, Jerry.
Sure. In terms of how much is out there, it's very interesting. There is a group called Truth About Trade Technology and Technology. It's an advocacy group that supports biotechnology, genetic engineering. And it wrote in a recent article, "Today we mark 1 billion acres. At some point in the future, like McDonald's, so many billion acres of biotech crops will have been planted and harvested around the world that we'll quit counting these biotech acres together, altogether. In other words, like McDonald's, how many billions of hamburgers are sold? They're going to stop counting pretty soon because today they marked a billion acres, and that, I believe, is 2004 when that happened. Now, when you have a billion acres all planted to GM seed, you're going to talk about a real pollen pollution problem here. And you know what? They're starting to talk about, in Europe, what is going to be an acceptable level of GM contamination in the food supply. What a despicable thing. They are having to resort now to say what will be acceptable. How do we know, Stan, what will be acceptable when we have no way of knowing what effects eating whole kernels of corn, whole ears of corn, all of them with the BT gene in them, are having on humans? Is it increasing the cases of asthma, allergic asthma? Is it increasing the risk of cancer because you are having novel proteins added to the human body and your body is responding in some way? Is it increasing autoimmune responses? We don't know the answers to the questions because there's no smoking gun. Cause and effect is so difficult to prove, and that's what saves this industry, is that you can't prove cause and effect.
But, of course, in the animal studies, there was very definite cause and effect.
Oh.
And sure, here you have, one group fed BT and the other fed non-BT products, and there were serious changes, in the white cells, serious changes in the liver and kidney, and the animals that got the BT, and they just totally ignored that. Say, well, it's not statistically significant, and it was statistically significant. And you would say, well, you're an alarmist. But I would like to suggest that there really are people out there who have a different vision of the world, who hate humanity. And if you doubt that, you need to read what they say. You need to read the Global Biodiversity Assessment. Read Agenda 21. Read my Population Control Agenda monograph, which is up on my webpage. And read what Jacques Cousteau said, that great humanitarian. Jacques Cousteau, quoted in the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991, saying, it's going to be necessary to eliminate 365,000 people a day. It'll be necessary to eliminate 365,000 people a day. It's a terrible thing to say, but it's got to be said. You would think that this quotation from a man who makes Adolf Hitler look like a piker would certainly be repeated by the media, but you see, when you control the media and you do not want the American people to know what lies ahead, you're never going to see these things quoted. You need to go and get my Population Control Agenda monograph. Read through what these people are talking about. Reducing the world population from 6 billion to 2 billion to 1 billion. To 500 million, to 200 million, maybe even 100 million. And how would you do something like that? Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti. And I think it's vitally important that you understand there are people who have a different worldview, and because they worship a different God. And when you understand that, so much of what's going on in the world today begins to take on an entirely different perspective. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute. Well, Dr. Stan here. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on something you said, Stan. Even, let's say, for those who might not agree with the idea that there is an agenda to decrease population willfully and so on. I mean, we all know that that happens, if no other way, in wars, right? And chemical attacks and biological attacks and so on. But even if you didn't believe that, you still have to look at the realities. The technologies that we're introducing willy-nilly will accomplish that same agenda, if you will, whether it exists broadly in the world or just in a handful of people, as it seems to do in pockets all around the world. What happens is our arrogance, the creation of technologies like the Terminator. For those who don't remember what that's about, you can read the initial articles, and they're free. You can go to our website, ARK Institute.com, food supply updates. Go back to June of 1998. You'll see the initial articles and the follow-up articles. Take a look at those. If you get a Terminator gene out there, and that, by the way, is being pushed right now as we speak around the world, and they are pushing that as a green technology. Why is it green? Because by terminating or making it impossible for a seed to reproduce itself, they're saying that that will be the limiting factor. That will be the gene that will keep GMO pollens from spreading around the world, because it'll prevent them from reproducing themselves in the environment. What the foxes aren't telling you is that the Terminator gene itself, which was designed to prevent you from replanting your own seed and feeding yourself next year without their help, without their seed, what they're not telling you is that if that pollen gets out into the environment, which it will, like all God's other pollen, that that is going to prevent closely related plants from reproducing themselves, from seeds growing, ending the cycle of seed to plant to seed to plant, the God-given nature-supporting cycle of seeding plants. They don't tell you that. They're pushing that agenda because it's a whole new, in quotes, market, or should I say in caps, market. And market is what this is about, and bottom line and profit is what this is about.
All right, hold that thought right there, Jerry. We want to bring our other stations right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Jerry Guidetti from the ARK Institute. And before we go on, Jerry, would you get your website out again and your telephone number so people would know how to get in touch with you if they're interested in more information on the seeds, the heritage seeds that you have that are certainly not genetically modified?
Sure. It's ARK, A-R-K, Institute. All is one word, ARKINSTITUTE.com or 1-800-255-1912, 1-800-255-1912. And yeah, these are, you're right, Stan, these are all heirloom seeds. They are, we have been providing collections to people, mini collections of 20 seed varieties or full collections of 40 seed varieties, and we ask folks to just go ahead and freeze them, follow the directions. If you don't want to grow them all out this year, next year, the following year, that's fine, you can freeze them. But we really ask people to take these into their homes right now and save these as heritage for their children and their grandchildren, because the reality is they are disappearing, and I don't know. I am being as dirt honest with you as I can be. I don't know if they're going to be available next year, because the genetic pollution is becoming so intense that it is very difficult to get growers anywhere to grow things and assure us, when we ask them to grow out varieties, to assure us that they're not going to be contaminated. Now, here at the ARK Institute, we provide a lot of seed to people all around the world. You can't grow all of your seeds in one location. You have to grow them all over the place in order to get the quantities that we need. And so this is becoming a progressively more difficult project to get these things out there. So we've been asking people, and God bless the ones who are holding in their freezers and in their gardens our original 50 packs back in from 1996 and 97, you are sitting on a treasure more valuable than gold. And we ask folks to understand that the seeds truly are more valuable than gold, because you're not going to be able to plant gold to get it to grow to feed yourself in the future. These things are the kinds of things that are passed down from generation to generation. So I'll shut up about it, but I really am passionate about it, as you know, And again, they can reach us at 1-800-255-1912. But at any rate, the problem is intense, unfortunately. It's getting worse by the day. And we were all sold this bill of goods, or well, I wasn't sold, but a lot of people were sold the bill of goods that these genetically modified seeds were going to reduce pesticide use because the genes were going to have the pesticides in them and prevent or disease resistance and prevent the need for pesticides. Well, a study just came out and they compared pesticide use before and after genetically modified corn, soybeans, and cotton. And here's the bottom line. The GE corn, soybeans, and cotton have led to a 122 million pound increase in pesticide use since 1996 alone, while BT crops have reduced insecticide use by 15.6 million pounds over this period. Herbicide-tolerant crops, for example, Roundup Ready crops, have increased herbicide use 138 million pounds. So BT crops have reduced insecticide use on corn and cotton about 5%, while herbicide-resistant technology has increased herbicide use about 5% across three major crops. So, because so much herbicide is used on corn, soybeans, and cotton, compared to the volume of insecticide applied to corn and cotton, overall, pesticide use around the world has now increased 4.1% on acres planted to GE varieties. That quote from Charles Benbrook, genetically engineered crops and pesticide use in the United States, the first 9 years, Biotech InfoNet technical paper number 7, October 2004. So there you have it.
And I think if you go to Jerry's website, that's the arkinstitute.com. That's arkinstitute.com. And you'll find so much of the material that she talks about, and you need to know what's happening. Because how can we get by without food? Can you really trust the people, you know, in the government to be completely forthright with us? And they have their agenda. Some of the people, I'm sure, are very well paid for just looking the other way when the major corporations want to come in, whether new genetically modified this or genetically modified that. And there are no adequate studies to show that they're safe. And we've seen what's happened to the youth of this nation. One in every six American children is either has a neurodevelopmental abnormality or a behavioral abnormality. About one in every six children has asthma. And government officials say, oh, shucks, we have no idea where this is happening. It's not happening in the Amish children that don't get their vaccines. But we're sure that if it has nothing to do with vaccines, you could trust us. Why, we would never do anything to hurt children. Well, if they are unconcerned about what's happening to our children, the fact that when our kids graduate from high school, on average, they are among the lowest ability to think in the entire world. Is this happening simply by accident? We spend more money per capita on our education than any other country, and yet, if you look and see the competitive scores of our high school graduates with the graduates of other countries, we can't compete at all. Can we simply sit back and say we've got nothing to worry about, or should we perhaps begin to think maybe we have to begin looking into these issues, find out what's really going on? Because after all, if we have a family, God gave us those children, and it's our responsibility to make sure that nothing is happening that's going to be harmful to them for the remainder of their lives. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, if you're listening to this program being rebroadcast on the Here's Help Network in the afternoon, why, don't bother to call, because this is a pre-recorded program. But if you're out listening to our program tonight across America, again, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Jerry, she's certainly one of the most knowledgeable people on genetically modified foods and, of course, on simply how to grow your food that you need for yourself and your family, And really, you don't need an awful lot of space to do that, Jerry, do you?
No, you really don't, Stan. As a matter of fact, we've recommended, we've counseled people, have been counseling people for years, from executives of corporations down to elderly folks who live in retirement homes and so on. And we have told them it doesn't matter that you don't have a great deal of land. It doesn't matter if you even have a backyard. If you have a sunny patio, for example, or a deck in your apartment building, and you get sun there a good 6 hours a day, 7 hours a day, you can plant so many of the seeds, these heirloom seeds. You can pick up, for example, good bags of potting soil, either with fertilizer already in them or buy organic fertilizers yourself and fertilize them after they've germinated. And you can plant your small plants into these bags of soil, poke holes in these bags of soil all around, stand them up on end. So you can put, you know, you know these white bags and brown bags of soil I'm talking about. You can take these things and you can stand them up like soldiers on their ends and poke holes in them with a big meat fork like you used to carve a turkey with, so that they have plenty of holes to drain water out of them. Slice open the top of the bag, and you can plant a tomato plant in each one of those. You can plant pepper plants in them. You could even play around planting corn just for the fun and the experiment of it all. But you can plant so many of these things. You can then stack them, and you can grow, or even in grocery bags lined with plastic bags that have got holes poked in them, you can grow beets and carrots and spinach and all kinds of vegetables right there on your patio or your deck. And in the backyard, of course, all things are possible. What I've done, everybody always laughs, any houseplants I've ever grown in my life, I lose interest in pretty quickly and they just die away. And I have a very green thumb. It's just that my orientation is always toward food, and global food supply issues are my major writing area and so on, my research area. And so it's always in my landscaping as much edible landscaping as possible. Strawberries and blueberries and beets, which make gorgeous landscaping plants, carrots for feathery, ferny type growth, and so on. You don't have to have a huge garden space. You could plunk these things down many times in between things that you already have in the landscape. You don't want them in the shade underneath trees. You don't want them in the shade underneath shrubs, but you want to put them out like in a bark chipped area out toward the front and so on, and start growing some of your own food. Even if you were to raise one tomato plant, one pepper plant, a handful of spinach and so on, and freeze the rest for next year or future years should you need it, you are ahead of 90% of the crowd in your ability to raise your own food and also to preserve these seeds for your future should you need them. Now, we're looking at, and you've commented on this many times before, Stan, on threats, global threats, and Lord knows we have many, many of them today. It's not just bioterrorism or agroterrorism, which our government is getting very panicky about right now. There are people working behind the scenes trying to prevent this from happening, but they know that the experimentation is going on to try to contaminate all of the crops that are growing in the United States, for example, and our animals, to kill off our food stocks. But we have still growing and still worsening, and we're not seeing it in our papers now. We have the bird flu situation is expanding. China just announced its seventh known human case. We know for a fact that there are many more than seven cases in China in humans. There are many cases in Indonesia. We have growing numbers of clusters of person-to-person transmission. So what happens if this goes global and we lose the productivity of 50% of the people around the globe in, say, a three-month period of time when seed is being raised, when farmers are supposed to be working their fields? The truth is we could end up the same way as you get a gigantic earth catastrophic volcano around the Earth, you could end up with a foodless summer. Well, the gene giants have made it impossible for the people, the farmers who depend on them for seed, they've made it impossible for them to grow food without that seed. Well, you have to have farmers, you have to have commercial operators of all of this machinery, and you have to have the scientists and the lab workers who are creating these seeds in order to eat this year. So the only hope of any culture has ever been, for survival, has been their seed that they keep at home. And governments everywhere are trying to take that seed out of their people's hands. I could quote you hundreds of cases where people, where governments have put such restrictions on the ownership of seed for the purpose of denying their people the right to grow their own in order to throw the money at their corporations, their seed companies, supposedly for the good of the crops.
Well, let's go to Maggie, who's calling us from Texas here. Hi, Maggie. Did you have a question for Jerry?
Good evening. Yes.
Speak up a little.
Yes, sir. I worked for Monsanto about 20 years ago. And at that time, the big product in their agricultural products division was not Roundup, although Roundup existed. It was a product called Lasso, which was billed as a pre-emergent.
I remember that.
And what I'm wondering if you could tell me, ma'am, is why was Lasso abandoned? Because that was a very, very, very big deal. And I don't think it required a genetically engineered corn seed, although there was talk of that. The idea was you would treat the ground and it would attack the weeds specific to corn and soybeans so that they would never get started, and it didn't require further spraying.
Well, let's ask Jerry.
As a matter of fact, I don't know which of the EPA rulings was the one that finally took that out of commission. But most of those, and I just don't recall, it probably was when I was quite young and wasn't in that research yet. I started out in microbiology, and it wasn't in agricultural microbiology, but human pathogenic microbiology. And so I would say that it probably was when we really started noticing the effects of the chemicals on soil, when the whole chemical revolution was questioned, and that was in, say, the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and many of these herbicides and these pre-emergents were pulled off the market. Many of them had estrogenic qualities to them and were polluting the soil with estrogen. Others were killing off organisms that were essential for breakdown of organic matter. So without looking that up and researching that right now on the air, Maggie, I couldn't help you with the specifics, but many chemicals, like dioxin, for example, were withdrawn during that time.
Now, was this EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, stepping in?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe it was EPA. And, you know, most of those chemicals were very bad indeed. We're getting better in that we're creating things that break down faster in the environment, but it's those other effects, for example, nature adapting to certain chemicals, causing resistance to those chemicals, and therefore making them ineffective, and so we have to use more and more and more and more of it in order to get it to work, and that is happening right now with glyphosate or Roundup. We are having to use more Roundup in order to get the same effect. This is backfiring on them. Very big deal.
Maggie, anything else you want to say?
Just thank you for shedding light on that, because I've wondered about it for the last 20 years.
All right, fine. God bless, and you just keep listening, and Jerry
will
be back again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here with Jerry one more time. Jerry, let's get your telephone number out one more time.
Sure, 1-800-255-1912. ArcInstitute.com.
One more time for the telephone number.
1-800-255-1912. 1912.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Jerry Guidetti. And, Jerry, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up this program for tonight.
Okay. Well, basically, I think what we have to look at is people supporting certain companies, and you've heard a list of many of them tonight. The supporting of these companies and their products perhaps is counterproductive for your own survival in the long run. And I think since we have no control over the political network, we have no control over these people, I think we can vote with our purses. For example, I never use Roundup. I never would use Roundup because I don't want to support a company that does these kinds of things that I don't agree with. That is my personal opinion. Certainly you can have your own. But we're looking at the consolidation of all of the seed companies under fewer and fewer entities, and that means fewer and fewer men and women running these firms. I believe most of these are run by men. And this handful of people who could sit down at a large dinner table actually control about 51% of the global food supply. Think about that. You go to a wedding, you have a table that sits 10 people. Think about 10 companies. Think about their 10 CEOs sitting around a table deciding what's going to be happening with the global food supply. That scares me. So I would recommend that everybody take seriously. Spring is coming. Start thinking about getting seeds. Start putting in your seedlings on time in your area. Call your county extension service in your county directory and ask them for the planting schedule for vegetables in your area, and get your seeds, plan on keeping them for the rest of your life, growing them, multiplying them, harvesting them. We have a book, for example, Seed Sowing and Saving. It tells you how to do it all and how to save the seed and how to pass them on to your children and your grandchildren, because you'll know how to do it. These are lifelong skills, and you know what? It just may save your life someday and the lives of all your loved ones, and that is not an overstatement. I believe I am going to see it in my lifetime, and I pray that if you see it in your lifetime, you'll be well prepared to handle it because you saw the writing on the wall, you knew about it, and you know how to feed yourself.
Of course, it's these heirloom seeds that Jerry's talking about, and people say, why, this could never happen in America, and I would simply ask, why not? If God is just, why should you think that he would not bring a form of judgment on this country that is simply turned away from him? Jerry Guidetti, thank you so very much for being with
us
again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And I hope you don't get rained out up there.
I hope not.
Good night and God bless you.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and as I said earlier, I think there's so much information that is available on genetically modified seeds, and certainly the book by Jeffrey Smith, Seeds of Deception, and Craig Sciola's book, GMOs, Beware Genetically Modified Food. We have got a great 4-tape set on this subject, and if you're interested in getting any more information, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and go to Jerry's Guidetti's website at arcinstitute.com. Find out, is this simply hysteria, or is there really an agenda out there that could have a profound impact on the lives of my family and on my own life? Well, if you have any question at all about the things we're talking about, let me suggest you go to my website, which is www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. We have posted there something called the Population Control Agenda Monograph. I did it a number of years ago. One of these days, when I have a chance, I will update it. I have given a talk called Planned Population Reduction. That's Planned Population Reduction, which is on CD or DVD, that really brings things even more up to date. But you can go to my website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And simply pull down the Planned Population Reduction, pardon me, the Population Control Agenda Monograph, and read it through. or if you'd like to get a good copy of it, we'd be glad to send you one free of charge if you call us tonight at 1-800-544-8927. Just tell the girl there that I said you could have a free copy of the Population Control Reduction Monograph. We'll be glad to send that to you. We think it's important that you understand that there really are people who look at the world differently than normal people. They're the people who see nothing wrong with involving nations in wars and the horror and suffering to go along with that. But there's always an explanation, but it's given to the people and the men who fight and the families of those who lose their loved ones. But it's never the true cause. It's never the true objective. If you'd like to really understand what's going on in Iraq today, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for a copy of our treatise, our newsletter, entitled Deja Vu in Iraq. If you'd like to understand the energy crisis and why the cost of heating oil and natural gas and electricity and diesel and gasoline has gone up, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the newsletter Peak Oil 2. Please go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day. You won't get much accomplished, but you'll learn an awful lot. You can listen to our archive programs. Remember, we're also on the American Freedom Network at AmericaNewsNet.com. That's AmericaNewsNet.com. On the Genesis Network at GCNLive.com. And then, of course, feel free to copy our programs, pull down our newsletters, copy those. Encourage others to listen to our program, especially if you're listening on the Here's Help Radio Network. Remember, we do have a program in your area, in the Midwest, every Saturday at 12:30. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for Radio Liberty. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is under attack today. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Lee Penn. And Lee, we've interviewed him in the past on a book he's written, but we're going to be talking to him this evening about an article he had written for the Spiritual Counterfeit Project. That's a magazine that's published by our good friend Tal Brook. But Lee has written an article on Opus Dei, this is a fascinating subject. Most people had never heard of this organization until Dan Brown had written a book, really very very popular, a bestseller, called The Da Vinci Code. And this is the story of the curator of the Louvre Museum in Paris, who is killed by an albino monk who is a member of this secret Catholic society, Opus Dei. And of course, the Catholic monk goes around killing all sorts of people. And, of course, we're trying to find out the secret, and the secret of the Holy Grail, which is possessed by members of the Priory of Sion, which is supposedly another secret society. And we won't get into the Priory, whether this is a fraud or whether it's not, but Opus Dei is not a fraud. It's a very real Catholic secret society, or, as they prefer to say, we're not a secret society. We're simply a society with secrets. But if you read the story, it's a fascinating adventure story. And, of course, it's going to be coming out in movie form this year, starring Tom Hanks. And its real purpose is to destroy your faith in Christianity, and it does everything it can. Professedly, you know, supposedly presenting objective facts, but so much of it is not objective, other than the fact that there really is a Catholic secret society. The albino monk flagellates himself with a cat of nine tails and wears this sort of barbed wire around his thigh on a regular basis to inflict pain on himself. And as absurd as it seems, this is part of the ritual of this very real society with secrets. Well, Lee has done a tremendous job certainly writing about this. We've interviewed a Mr. John Allen, who has written a book called Opus Dei that is very, very favorable to the order. And, of course, now we're going to hear the other side. And so, Lee, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me this evening, Dr. Monteith.
Well, why don't you pick up the story? I've been doing all the talking. What motivated you to want to write this? Now, I think for our listeners, we should know that Lee is coming from the Catholic point of view. You are a conservative Catholic, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm a member of a traditional Eastern Rite Catholic parish, a church that is in communion with Rome, and we pray like the Eastern Orthodox and recognize our allegiance to the Holy See. I've written for conservative Catholic periodicals like The Wanderer and New Oxford Review, as well as for the Spiritual Counterfeits Project Journal and for Christian Challenge, which are Reformed, Protestant, and Anglican magazines. And my interest in Opus Dei arose because of my awareness of the increasing power of this organization, and as I learned more about it, I came to understand that its agenda was not just was to support Orthodox Catholicism, as it claims, or to help make its members more holy, as it claims. It has an agenda of power and control, and that its tools are political subterfuge and money.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lee Penn, and of course he's writing about this organization called Opus Dei, and basically, it is a power structure, and with any secret society, we should always be concerned with any organization where you have to sign a contract when you go into it, and you really don't understand the full implications of what you're getting into. It sounds so familiar, the purpose-driven church. It sounds so familiar of what's going on with Masonry. In fact, Masons don't say that we're not a secret society. We're a society with secrets. And that's exactly what they say in Opus Dei. So pick up the story there, Lee.
Okay. Opus Dei has a public face and a private face. In publicly, it says that its aim is to, quote, help people live by the gospel in their daily activities and make Christ present in every endeavor. Opus Dei focuses on work and daily life as an occasion for spiritual growth and an opportunity to contribute to a better world. And they say that they emphasize unity of life, prayer, sacrifice, charity, apostolate, and fidelity to the Pope.
Now, of course, from a Catholic point of view, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah. And the problem is that they have a long track record of supporting right-wing collectivist governments. They were active supporters of the Franco dictatorship in Spain from the 1930s through the fall of that regime in the mid-1970s. Escrivá himself was sympathetic to the Nazis during World War II.
Now, could you explain to our listeners who Escrivá was?
Escrivá was the founder of Opus Dei. He started the movement in 1928, and he says that it was in response to a divine vision where God revealed the nature of this organization that he wanted founded and explained what it would have to be over the course of the centuries. And supposedly, the movement is going to exist in the church until the second coming of Christ.
All right, fine. So basically then the founder of this had some sort of revelation, and he was told to organize this group to bring people into a closer relationship to God or to our Lord, and also to sanctify themselves through this infliction of pain and on themselves, and this total dedication, their whole life centers around their faith, and you're talking about many lay people who then will be celibate for the rest of their lives, or at least the inner core of this, as part of the demonstration of their dedication to their faith. Is that it?
That's precisely it. There's about 85,000 members worldwide, and the inner ring, the core of the movement, is...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lee Penn, and he's simply pointing out that this is a very unusual organization, this Opus Dei. It seems to support the very right-wing totalitarian governments, as it did with the government of Franco in Spain, which, of course, it was where it originated. And then, of course, it really causes the people, the members, to be totally dedicated to what it's doing and following really with blind obedience. So you pick up the story there.
Okay. There are different levels of membership, as with the Masons. At the inner ring are the numeraries. They're the most dedicated 20% of the movement, and they are celibate for life. They're men and women. They live in Opus Dei dormitories in separate quarters, and these are the people who, as part of their habit, will flagellate themselves 33 times with a cat of nine tails once a week, and will, except on Sundays and feast days, wear the chiliche, the piece of barbed wire around their legs to inflict pain upon themselves. Then there's 10% of the movement are associates, and they're celibate, but they live with their families outside of the dormitories. And that leaves 70% of the movement, the supernumeraries. They're married, and they have their own jobs, live with their families, and they give money to the movement. In addition, there's about 150,000 cooperators who are not members but support the movement with time and money.
Now, I think the interesting thing is about 88,000 members?
85,000 members, about 49,000 in continental Europe, about 26,000 in Latin America, 3,000 here in the States, the rest scattered around the rest of the world.
But I think they have 3,000 people in the United States. They have a 17-story building in New York City?
Right. It's a skyscraper in downtown Manhattan, and the real estate is not cheap there. And Forbes magazine says that the movement raises $49 million or so every year, and that would mean that every Opus Dei member would be raising $16,000 per member. That's a pretty high fundraising yield.
All right. Well, go ahead. And so basically now, do these people sort of help one another to get ahead? Is there sort of like it is with Masonry where you actually, you get into the organization and then one person helps another to get to a high position? Because many of these people in this secret organization really are in key positions in industry and other fields, aren't they?
Yes, they're very good at getting themselves and their friends into positions of power. Even after the fall of the Franco government in Spain, the Opus Dei is still very, very strong in Spain, and many of the leaders of the government that ruled Spain until 2004, the conservative government, were Opus Dei members. So are some members of the royal family, the Archduke of Habsburg, an heir to the Austrian throne, is a active Opus Dei supernumerary, and Opus Dei has a network of friends in Washington D.C. as well, especially among conservative, neoconservative, and Republicans.
Well, then, what you're suggesting is that this is really a very, very powerful organization with power far outside the number of members. With only 85 members throughout the world, you wouldn't think that they would have that much power.
That's right. But they recruit among the intellectual elite and among the social elite, especially. And so they go for people who can wield influence. And, of course, their lifestyle, which is a very rigorous and disciplined lifestyle, helps people succeed materially. And Escrivá's teachings encourages people to single-mindedly focus on business success and not to give away the fruits of their labors. As he said, it's human nature to have little appreciation for what costs but little. That's why I recommended to you the apostolate of not giving. Never fail to claim what is fairly and justly due to you from the practice of your profession, even if your profession is the instrument of your apostolate. In other words, this says that an Opus Dei doctor is not really supposed to cut his rates or give away his services if he wants to give some private help to poor patients.
But now, of course, what does he do with the money that he has? And because obviously, if he's making a lot of money, does he give part of that to the Opus Dei?
If he's a cooperator or a supernumerary, he'll give part of it to Opus Dei. And if he's a numerary associate or a numerary, he makes his paychecks over to Opus Dei and gets a little allowance back.
In other words, for the numeraries, which are the top 20%, they get all of their money.
That's right. Yeah, it's they say they're not a religious order, but they really are a religious order. They when you have people who live communally in dormitories and they're celibate and they're separated by sex and they give all their money to the movement leaders and their mail is read by their superiors, they're supposed to make confessions only to Opus Dei priests, they're supposed to tell their spiritual superiors everything that's going on in their lives, including their secrets and their faults, once a week. So it's a very, especially at the top levels of the movement, it's a very enclosed, constrictive lifestyle.
Well, now my understanding is that when people come into the order, they are certainly encouraged to come in, they can be recruited to come in, and then they're required to sign a contract, and then they're almost isolated from the world, from their families. They are simply to dedicate themselves totally to this, and they're not allowed to go to family gatherings and things of that sort. Is that true?
That's true. Again, in particular for those who are in training to be numeraries or those who are already numeraries. The idea is that, especially for women numeraries, that going to family functions will restore the bonds of affection between themselves and their families so that might weaken their commitment to the movement or even tempt people to leave. Recruitment into the movement can start as early as adolescence. Opus Dei emphasizes its apostolate of education, so they have study circles and training centers for late elementary school kids, junior high kids, high school kids, and of course lots of presence in various and sundry university campuses, including near Harvard. And they run Spain's most prominent university in Navarre, and they they recruit people, and they don't necessarily tell people at the beginning, here's why you're being invited to come to this lecture, here's why we are wining and dining you, here's why we're being so friendly to you. But sooner or later, of course, people get brought into the movement, and then they sign annual contracts for up to 6 years, and then they are supposed to make a lifetime commitment. And the numeraries are told that making this commitment is a very serious thing, and that you might be losing your salvation if you leave the movement, which is rather similar to the way the Legionaries of Christ, which is another authoritarian cult within the Catholic Church, teaches their members. The slogan there is "Lost vocation, sure damnation." And that's a very classic cult mind control practice. The Moonies do it, other cults do it, where they tell people that salvation is to be found only within this specific cult and everybody else is doomed.
Well, really what you're really describing is almost, it is a cult within the Catholic Church, where, of course, they play mind control games. And don't they really condition your mind so that you totally blind obedience to the order?
Yes, and blind obedience is what Escrivá wanted. He has a book called The Way, which is has sold several million copies around the world, and both friends and enemies of the movement say that this book that came out in the late 1930s is the Bible for the movement. But here are a few quotes from him. "Obedience, the sure way. Blind obedience to your superior, the way of sanctity. Obedience in your apostolate, the only way, for in a work of God the Spirit must be to obey or to leave." And then further on, your perfection consists in living perfectly in the place, occupation, and position to which God, through those in authority, has assigned to you. And again, you have come to the apostolate to submit, to annihilate yourself, not to impose your own personal viewpoints. You know, this evening I was rereading part of 1984, and the inner party inquisitor tells one of his prisoners stuff exactly like this. And he's talking, of course, about the totalitarian socialist party that rules the world in the novel 1984.
Now, was that O'Brien?
That was O'Brien, right, yes.
And, of course, it's fascinating, his discussions with Winston Smith. I think everybody should reread 1984, but what you're really talking about is this same sort of a structure, authoritarian structure within really it is a secret Catholic society. I don't think you can say we're a society with secrets, but, of course, that's simply a cover, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the movement does have and has kept many secrets. It is engaging in some Gorbachev-style glasnost in the last 10 or 15 years. It used to be that its constitution was kept strictly under wraps, and that other movements, a teaching journal called Kronika, a manual of operations called Praxis, various other documents were so tightly controlled that people were given copies of this by their directors, told to study them, and then made to turn them back in at the end of the study session so that they couldn't trot out to the nearest copy center and make and distribute copies of these things. And John Allen has had the privilege of looking at some of these documents, and he essentially says, move along, there's nothing to see, and what's wrong with having the movements have their own secrets?
And John Allen, of course, is the author of the book Opus Dei, which we've interviewed. Mr. Allen, fascinating interview. But there's very, very strong support in the Vatican for this in key places, isn't there?
Very, very much. And I can give you the details about the Vatican support for Opus Dei and their power within the Church when we come back from the break.
All right, fine. And our guest, of course, is Lee Penn. And of course, you can get his information at the SCP inc.org. We'll let Lee give that. Maybe I'm not giving quite the right website, but it's pretty close. scp-inc.org. Lee, what is the website there? Did I get it right?
Yes, you did. It's scp-inc.org.
All right, fine. And that's a great site for lots of exciting information. But we were talking about the Vatican influence. In other words, this is an organization that seems to be really being touted and encouraged from the highest levels of the Vatican. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, it is. Pope John Paul II was a major proponent of Opus Dei. He committed very early in his pontificate to raise Escrivá to the level of sainthood, and this was only 3 years after Escrivá died. He named two cardinals from Opus Dei into that college, and the cardinals are the people who elect the popes and generally have powerful positions in Vatican bureaucracy, so they're a very important group of people. And then the Curia, which is the Vatican bureaucracy, the broader group of people who help the Pope run the Church, within that organization, the members of Opus Dei are rising and the opponents have been marginalized or made to retire. And there's 18 active Opus Dei bishops worldwide, including one in the U.S., one in Africa, three in Europe, the movement's own prelate, and 12 in Latin America.
Now, of course, here you're talking about 3,000 members of this organization in the entire United States. Isn't one bishop for 3,000 people an awful over-representation, as you might say? Doesn't that give them a tremendous power?
Well, it does. This bishop, Jose Gomez, had previously been the president of the National Association of Hispanic Priests. He was the vicar, in other words, the leader of Opus Dei in Texas. And he currently is Archbishop of San Antonio. And archbishops are rather important people in the Catholic Church.
All right, fine. So we're seeing that it's really a power structure, and of course it extends right into the Vatican. And certainly an organization with 85,000 people, and two of them are cardinals, that is true. And after what, about 100 or 200 priests in the organization?
There are 2,000 priests in the organization, about 83,000 lay people.
Okay, fine. And of course, if a member of the Opus Dei is to go to confession, does he have to go to an Opus Dei priest?
Under canon law, Catholics are supposed to be able to go to any priest for confession. But Escrivá said that those who didn't come to Opus Dei priest for confession were showing bad spirit. And he said that he would rather have members of his movement die without the sacraments than receive the last sacraments from a Jesuit. He hated the Jesuits, and of course the Jesuits returned the favor.
So here you see, of course, the two very, very powerful organizations within the Catholic Church at odds with one another. But why? I mean, what is this really all about? As you analyze this, as you study it, and we see the secret oaths, at least the contracts that these people have to sign. Do they really understand when they sign the contract what they're getting into?
I think that the understanding comes gradually, and that there are many who are rank and file members of Opus Dei who just do some beneficial work in favor of Orthodox Christianity, or doing social relief work or other missionary activities, and they don't hurt anybody. In fact, they may help some people. But there are plenty of instances where Opus Dei members have obtained powerful positions and used them in a harmful manner.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Lee Penn, who writes for a Spiritual Counterfeits Project. He's talking about Opus Dei, which is a secret Catholic organization with some very, very strange requirements that certainly has a tendency to totally isolate the people, at least as far as interpersonal relationships, from those who are not within this movement. It is very, very powerful, very, very rich and wealthy. How much wealth does does Opus Dei actually have?
I think that the number that John Allen came up with was assets of about $2.4 billion, which he tends to downgrade by saying that its assets and its membership base are equivalent to that of a small Catholic diocese in a remote part of the world. But that understates the real reach of the movement, because these 85,000 members are not just like ordinary members of a Catholic diocese. They're activists. They're leaders. They are opinion makers. They're supposed to help run things, and their mission is to conquer the world for the Church, in their own words.
Well, now, of course, do they, once they're in this organization, do they talk about it to others on the outside? Do they let everybody know they're part of it? Or do they more or less keep secret the fact that they're part of Opus Dei?
To a large extent, the tradition has been to keep secret the fact that they are Opus Dei members until it's necessary to reveal it. That was written into the 1950 Constitution. And one of the odd things that remains true until this day about Opus Dei houses and dormitories and Opus Dei-owned enterprises is that they have nondescript names. Most Catholic institutions will have names that clearly say that it's dedicated to some saint, or it might be like Holy Trinity School. It's a name that will clearly tell anyone who finds out about the organization this is a religious, indeed a Catholic group. And Opus Dei organizations will have bland names like Oakdale or Westview Heights or other names that don't suggest any religious affiliation at all.
Almost as if they're trying to conceal what they're doing.
It would almost seem that way. And one of the things that needs to be remembered about Opus Dei is that they really think they're going to stick around as an organization until the second coming of Christ. The Opus Escriva's successor said, "Our founder's message and example are not just for a few, but for millions of men and women until the end of time." And Escriva said in 1966 that the task that awaits us is immense. It is a sea without shores. As long as there are men on earth, no matter how much techniques of production may change, they will have some kind of work that can be offered to God and sanctified. So they think they're going to be around permanently, and they don't think the nature of the organization is going to have to change terribly much.
Well, now, is the purpose a personal sanctification? Is the purpose good works? Is the purpose power and control?
In practice, the purpose is power and control. You have the example of Robert Hansen, who spied for the Soviet Union for many years. He was a devout member of Opus Dei. He was not a numerary, but he was married. But his wife caught him counting $100 bills in the basement in the early 1980s, and said, "Where did you get this?" And she made him go to confession with an Opus Dei priest, who said he should give the money to Mother Teresa. But whatever the Opus Dei priest said, apparently the advice did not include quit spying or turn yourself in, because Hansen kept spying for the Soviets and getting hundreds of thousands of dollars for almost another decade.
And, of course, does the Opus Dei have a profound impact on some of our government structure? In other words, does it influence governments throughout the world?
It does. As I mentioned previously, Opus Dei was very powerful in the Spanish government that ruled that country until 2004, and that was a government that was strongly aligned with the U.S. in the Iraqi War, and it's with the fall of that government that, of course, Spain has pulled out of Iraq, and the Spanish government, the new socialist government, is distancing itself from the Americans in every way.
All right. And so what about here in the United States? What about the influence here?
The influence here is substantial as well. One of the most prominent Opus Dei priests in the country is Father C. John McCloskey. And he's been busy making converts among prominent conservative Republicans and bringing them into the Catholic Church and training them in the Opus Dei fashion.
All right. Well, when we get back here, I think we'll try to get a little bit more into how these people, this organization, influences the structure of governments throughout the world, and specifically right here in the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Lee Penn, and we're talking about Opus Dei, which is a secret Catholic organization which was popularized by Dan Brown in his book, The Da Vinci Code. And so we were talking about what influence does this secret organization have here on the government of the United States. And certainly, Lee was saying that certain one of the members, one of the priests, has been recruiting certain members of the legislature into the structure. Are these people joining Opus Dei, or are they simply becoming subservient to it, or working with it, or?
I would think that they're getting recruited into the Catholic Church, not into Opus Dei per se, but they're getting their training and spiritual formation in an Opus Dei center in Washington, D.C. So they're probably being taught the Opus Dei way. Father McCloskey received Robert Bork, the conservative Catholic judge, into the Catholic Church in 2003. His other recruits include conservative book publisher Alfred Regnery, Republican Kansas Senator Sam Brownback, and a CNN commentator Larry Kudlow. Some people who are reported to be friendly to Opus Dei are Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, and I don't have to speculate about Senator Santorum of Pennsylvania's support for Opus Dei. He's not a member, but I've read one of his articles where he said that Opus Dei and the Legionaries of Christ and these other new ecclesial movements, those groups that I call cults within the Catholic Church, that are doing a great work of God.
Well, certainly they take the right position or the proper position on moral issues, don't they?
Well, they do take the proper position on the major culture war issues. This would be things like abortion or pornography or the other aspects of the parts of Catholic morality that pertain to chastity, but in practice, Opus Dei members can be involved in some other much more nefarious things. Switching back to Latin America, the diocese of Opus Dei Bishop Archbishop Cipriani has been the center of a brutal civil war between the army and the communists, and Cipriani, according to a reliable report, consistently defended the armed forces against charges of atrocities, and he dismissed human rights organizations as Marxists.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is Lee Penn. We're talking about the influence of Opus Dei, and certainly pointing out that in one area where one of the Opus Dei priests was justifying the military, and certainly which was in opposition to the Marxists, but certainly one reason that certainly the Opus Dei would have supported Franco, because the alternative was communism, and certainly in many places in the world today, you either have the regime that is there, or you overthrow it, and it's replaced by a Marxist regime, and you would expect that people would do everything they could to oppose a communist takeover.
Yeah, it's an easy temptation to fall into, but note the long-term spiritual result of the Franco dictatorship. The church in Spain is in poor condition. The figures I've seen show that 18% of the Spanish Catholics go to Mass once a month. And this is in comparison to the statistics here in the States, where Opus Dei is very weak and we've never had a dictatorship, where among Catholics and among Protestants about 45% go to church once a week. And in Spain, where Opus Dei is so very strong, only less than one-fifth of Catholics practice their religion even once a month. And the anti-clericalism is very widespread there, and people reacted to the Opus Dei influenced government that ruled until 2004 by throwing them out, electing socialists, and the socialists had been busy passing a spate of laws that would make Hillary Clinton very, very happy. So Opus Dei power in the state is not a way to inculcate the virtue and fidelity and love of Christ among the people. We have that lab test to show that their way doesn't work.
All right, fine. So basically what you're saying is that this organization is really about power and influence. And, of course, we talk about sanctity and changing the hearts of men, but you see, what you're really seeing is the regimentation and this total submission of the people to the rulers of this secret cult-like organization?
That's right. And I can even throw out some more data points, some instances where Opus Dei leaders' failure to observe certain basic morality harmed their stated mission. In Venezuela in 2002, and this is from a report from Newsmax.com, which is itself a very conservative paper, there was a military coup against the leftist, or perhaps we might even say communist, President Hugo Chavez, and the insurgents installed Pedro Carmona as the interim president. And Carmona's allies backed out when he selected all Opus Dei members for his cabinet. So as a result, the coup collapsed, and the communists, Mr. Chavez, returned to power. So Carmona, who was the coup leader, never learned the political equivalent of the investing slogan, bulls can make money, bears can make money, but hogs never make money. Opus Dei apparently wanted to hog the new Venezuelan regime that would succeed Chavez, and because they were hogs, the movement collapsed and the left-wingers are back in power.
All right, so, and basically then the force behind this revolution, what you're suggesting, was this Opus Dei, the movement within Venezuela?
Right. Opus Dei with significant support from the U.S. government as well.
So you think the U.S. government was really involved with this this effort to take over Venezuela?
I would guess that that Opus Dei plus the U.S. government plus disaffected parts of the Venezuelan society that didn't want left-wing government. They all cooperated to try to get Chavez out, but it didn't work. And in part, of course, Opus Dei greed for having all the power in that new regime was one of the reasons why the coup failed.
And now, is there a large Catholic component in Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela is a traditionally Catholic society, and so as in much of the rest of Latin America, the Catholic Church has historically been aligned with the elite.
All right. Now, is Opus Dei very strong there, or was this simply a very small minority that were seizing control of the government? In other words, there are a lot of members of Opus Dei in Venezuela?
I don't know the exact number of Venezuelan Opus Dei members, but there's 26,000 Opus Dei members in all of Latin America, so maybe there is a couple or 3,000. And one of the former Opus Dei members in Venezuela was a woman named Maria del Carmen Tapia, and she defected in 1966 from the movement and has written a book called Crossing the Threshold, Beyond the Threshold, which is all about what it's really like to be an Opus Dei numerary and how cultic and controlling that environment was.
Well, now, what do these people say? I mean, the people who've been in this and they've left Opus Dei, even though they may have signed the lifetime contract. So, and they are actually threatened with the loss of their salvation in eternity in hell, really, if you leave the organization. So there has to be a tremendous motivation to leave.
Yeah, for some members, apparently, it's not terribly traumatic when they leave. They just decide, this isn't for me, and they quit, and they leave on good terms. But in some cases, Opus Dei pushes back really hard, and as in one case, they took a fellow who wanted to leave, and they showed him the grave of a former Opus Dei member, and said, well, he was so depressed that he quit taking his heart medicine, and this is what might happen to you. And with another guy, he left and got married and had three kids, but one of the kids died prematurely, so his former Opus Dei superior showed up and then told him that the death of the child was part of God's judgment on him.
So they're really playing sort of a fright game. They're really manipulating these people even after they've left the order.
That's right. They try to maintain their control wherever and however they can.
You know, you wonder why anybody would go into something of this sort. I suppose there's some people, though, who want that regimentation of their lives. It's sort of some same sort of thing that happens when people go into the military, except there's not this strong spiritual aspect that's holding them or binding them.
Yeah, well, people join cults because they want direction, they want certitude, and maybe they're lonely, and this is a way for them to have a life if they haven't had one before. And certainly Opus Dei, if it recruits among people who are attracted to conservative or orthodox Catholicism, they can say, the world is chaos, much of the church is in chaos, join us, you'll be spiritually safe, you'll grow in spiritually, you'll become holy, and they might even drop the hints that if you follow our way, you too can help lead things.
Well, certainly we know that many people become monks. They become a Buddhist monk because, you know, certainly totally immersing yourself in that can give at least a certain meaning to life. Do you think a lot of these people are just looking for a meaning to their lives to make it really with the hope that they're going to be able to draw closer to our Lord?
I think that that's true, and it's one of the reasons why these various cultic groups within the Catholic Church have grown. The broader context is that much of the structure of the Catholic Church has disintegrated, decayed, become weak since Vatican II over the last 40 years. So as a counter-reaction, almost, you have the Opus Dei, the Legionaries of Christ, the Neo-Catechumenal Way, and they put themselves forward as the last remnant in the Catholic Church, as the defenders of orthodoxy. They're zealous, they proselytize, they evidence no doubt about what they're doing and where they're going, and they say, follow us, we'll bring you to holiness, and we'll show you the true way to Christ. Of course, all of these three organizations are rivals with each other, each has their own way, and Opus Dei leaders call Escrivá our Father in Heaven, the followers of the Legionaries of Christ call Maciel Machel, their still living founder, Nuestro Padre, our Father, and other groups have similar cults around their founders and leaders, whether they be alive or dead.
Well, after you've done all of your work on it, you've studied it, you've analyzed it, and I understand now you have a second article that will be coming out here very, very soon in the Spiritual Catholic Project magazine.
Yes, yes. Part two should be in print in April, and you should have it in your hands by the end of April.
All right, fine. What is your final take on it? And should we be fearful of this? Should we simply say, well, these people would probably be better off not getting involved? Or is there something sinister about this at all?
Any organization that drapes itself in holiness but actually has an agenda that is much more about control, domination, power, and money has to be looked at very carefully with real suspicion. Some of the greatest crimes have been committed by fanatics, by those who are so sure they're right that they can't admit to themselves or to others that they could be wrong. So it is necessary, I think, to be concerned about the rise of Opus Dei and to look very carefully at any organizations or movements that it allies with or infiltrates, and to try to bring sunlight and exposure to the activities of Opus Dei so they can't just sneak in where they wish to sneak in.
Well, do you see any parallels between Opus Dei and Masonry as far as their structure is concerned, or actually as far as their concealing their true objectives from the recruits and as far as the power structure?
The Opus Dei people would hate to hear this parallel expressed, but yes, clearly there is a parallel. I'm not saying there's an organization overlap between Opus Dei and Masonry. It's just that independently these two movements have come up with a rather similar structure. And if anything, I think that the structure in Opus Dei is stricter, more rigorous, and more resistant to outside influence, more resistant to reform than the Masons might be. And we could call, the Masons call themselves they say they're not a secret society, they say they are a society with secrets, And obviously Opus Dei isn't a secret society per se. As they say, you can't have a secret society that has a huge skyscraper in downtown Manhattan, but they are a society with secrets.
And, of course, if you're out there listening audience, you have a question for Lee, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. This is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And could you give the website again where people will be able to get copies of Part 1 of your article and then, of course, get Part 2 there when it comes out in April?
Certainly. It's www.scp-inc.org. Again, scp-inc.org. Or they could call the SCP during working hours, you know, West Coast time, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and order the magazine that way.
All right, well, let's go to Terry, who's calling us from, of all places, Santa Cruz. Hi, Terry. Do you have a question?
Yes, excellent program, Dr. Stan. It's good to hear the heavy hitters being exposed.
Okay, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, is there a... would you say the connection between Opus Dei and the Jesuits and other of these Catholic secret societies and Masonry happened through the Knights of Malta, which is one of the higher degrees of Masonry, and is a Catholic society itself?
Well, the Jesuits, I wouldn't call the Jesuits a secret society. They're a religious order that's been around since the early 1500s. They were certainly a very militant, very disciplined order for a long time, but since Vatican II, they have become internally incoherent and disunited. They might once have been the Pope's shock troops, but they are not that any longer. If anything, they tend more to be on the liberal dissident end of the Catholic Church.
Now, what's the relationship between the Jesuits and Opus Dei?
Well, the Jesuits and Opus Dei have been opposed to each other traditionally. There was some severe rivalry even under Franco Spain between the Jesuits and Opus Dei, and that rivalry and mutual opposition spread worldwide as Opus Dei spread. And as the Jesuits turned left and the Opus Dei remained very conservative, that opposition became an ideological and spiritual opposition as well.
Anything else you'd like to ask, Terry?
Yes, from what I've read, the Knights of Malta answered to the Black Pope, the Jesuit General. Confirm that?
Let's get. Have you heard anything at all about that?
I don't know much about the Knights of Malta. I know that they're a Catholic knightly order. I don't think they have any direct relationship with the Jesuits. And the Black Pope is a nickname for the Superior General of the Jesuit Order, just because the Jesuits at that level normally wear black cassocks.
Okay, thanks very much, Terry. And let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Jack, did you have a question?
Yes. Malachi Martin had mentioned the hierarchy, either of the Vatican or the Roman Catholic. It was infiltrated in a Luciferian context. I was wondering if the guest knows if there's any connection with the Vatican and the financing of the Opus Dei organization.
All right. So thanks very much, Jack. And certainly Malachi Martin had commented about the fact that there'd been Masonic and certainly even satanic infiltration of the upper echelons of the Vatican, because, of course, that's always been the objective, was to destroy the Catholic Church. And certainly he's asking if there's any connection between the Vatican and the financing of Opus Dei.
At one point, Opus Dei was proposing to help bail out some Vatican operations that were having financial trouble in the 1970s, but I don't think that deal went through, per se. Opus Dei does have money, and they do use it to support the Catholic Church generally, but I don't have the figures at hand about how much they use to bail out certain banks or Vatican operations or not.
Well, but, I mean, here, with the tremendous wealth of the Vatican, you would think the Vatican would be helping Opus Dei rather than Opus Dei helping the Vatican. Where are they getting the vast sums of money that Opus Dei would be able to help finance the Vatican?
Well, when you have 85,000 members, some of whom make all of their paychecks over to the movement, and others will tithe or more to the movement, and the people who are making tithes are themselves wealthy and well-placed people. And if you then have their friends, there's about 150,000 Opus Dei cooperators worldwide, some Catholics, some non-Catholics, some who are not even Christian at all, who are similarly giving money to the movement, and then influencing grants to go to Opus Dei-controlled organizations and schools. There's money can flow that way.
So we're really talking about tremendous sums of money, and with money comes power, doesn't it?
With money comes power. That's the saying, follow the money.
Right, right. We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program here. Our guest has been Lee Penn, and he writes for the Spiritual Counterfeits Project. What was that book that you wrote? We interviewed you on before, Lee?
The book is called False Dawn, The United Religions Initiative, Globalism, and the Quest for a One World Religion. And it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it's also available through the book website, falsedawn.us, falsedawn.us.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Of course, there really is a move towards a world government, and there is a move towards a world religion. And certainly this is the common denominator behind literally all of these organizations. Certainly, if you study Masonry, if you study Theosophy, you study the Rosicrucians, you go into the background of these people within the Council on Foreign Relations, we find them making common cause with the Church Growth Movement, and Rick Warren's back talking to the Council on Foreign Relations and filling them in on the latest developments. So there's always been a relationship between the structure of political power and the structure of ecclesiastic power. But if you're going to have a one-world government, you're going to have a one-world religion. Would that be fairly accurately?
It would. And my writing have dealt with both the right-wing and the left-wing variants of this. It's in both cases, these are collectivist totalitarian utopians. The people who support the United Religions Initiative, Mikhail Gorbachev, George Soros, Ted Turner, want a left-wing slash liberal slash New Age type of utopia, sort of pink communism, communism with a spiritual face. And that's, for the most part, what I wrote the book False Dawn about. But even in the last chapter of False Dawn, I mentioned the existence of groups like Opus Dei and the Legionaries of Christ. They also want to remake the world, and they also want their particular variant of Catholicism to be the world religion. And some of them even go so far as to say that after a chastisement of the world, that everybody will become Catholic, and that there will be a emperor that will rule Europe, and that the emperor and the pope together will restore order and rule with a rod of iron.
Well,
it would be right-wing collectivism.
Because that sounds very much like the warning we get from the revelation of Jesus Christ, you know, in the last book of the Bible, talking about, you know, how government and church will come together.
That's right. And symbolically, it might be that the ten-headed beast from the sea would be the left-wing collectivists, and symbolically, the beast with two horns from the land, who speaks like a lamb, but has uttered the words of a dragon, that might be the right-wing collectivists who are using the church for their own political ends.
And it seems that everybody is using everybody else, but they are using religion now to control the people. Well, Lee, we could go on for a long period of time, but it's getting late back where you are, and it's even getting a little late where we are. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with you, and I do hope that we can call on you again, and because I think your message is important. I think people need to know what Opus Dei is.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan. And the main thing to remember about Opus Dei is we need to pray for them.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. And Lee, did you have one parting thought for our listeners this evening?
Yes. For members of Opus Dei, as well as for people on the left who are our opponents, the opponents of true religion and true freedom, we need to pray for them. Our enemies need our prayers for their conversion and for their sanctification, for them to turn to God. They need our prayers far more than they need any kind of cursing from us. So pray for them. That's the most we can do.
I think that's a very, very important point. God bless you. Thanks so much, Lee.
God be with you. Good night.
Right. Okay, fine. Well, that was Lee Penn, and certainly we've been talking about Opus Dei. We do have an interview with Mr. Allen. We may very well go ahead and try to get together a four-tape set so that you can see all sides of the issue. But let me tell you that Christianity is under attack. Traditional Christianity is under attack today, and there really is an effort to bring about a one-world government and a new world religion. And you see this on all sides. This is why they had to get God and prayer out of our schools, so that couldn't yet even be mentioned. We shouldn't be necessarily pushing a Catholic or Protestant faith, but to take God and prayer out of our schools and the Ten Commandments, which is accepted by the Catholics and by the Protestants and by the Jews. The Ten Commandments are foundational to American civilization. And when the Ten Commandments is under attack, American civilization is under attack. And then this is why we can't mention intelligent creation in our schools. Why? Because we cannot have our children have any glimpse at all or any thought that there is a God who rules in the affairs of men. Well, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. We do hope that many of you will go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You'll pull down our newsletters. And, of course, if you don't have access to the Internet, well, if you'd like to get our latest newsletter on Iraq, what is really going on there, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we'd be glad to send you free of charge a copy of our newsletter. If you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and listen to our programs there on the Internet 5 hours a day. You could, of course, get our shortwave frequencies and listen that way. We have MP3 files posted on our webpage at SoundWave. We're available. Our programs are available. My program, 9 hours a day, and Christian programming, 24 hours a day with Joyce Riley and Chuck Chrismeyer and Butch Paul. Both the latter two are ministers. 24 hours a day on Telstar 5, if you're interested in that, inexpensive means of getting Christian programming that will keep you abreast of what's really going on in the world today. And then, of course, we do hope that you will tell others about our programs, because that's how we're getting the information out. And if you're listening on the Here's Help radio network in the afternoons when this program is rebroadcast, well, remember, we do have a program every Saturday at 12:30 there on the Here's Help radio network. And then, of course, we invite you to copy our newsletters and give them to other people. Encourage them to read them, to study them, to challenge them, to try to prove them wrong. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, to pray for revival in America, because if this country doesn't turn back to God, is there any reason why God should intervene and save America? And lastly, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, till next time, may the Lord be with you.